Just before you listen to today's episode, this is a quick message to remind you that if you like what you hear, you can help support History Hack, which is run entirely by volunteers using our Patreon account. There are links on all of our episodes. Or if a subscription is not your thing, you can also now drop us a line on Ko-fi, which is just the equivalent of buying us a drink. So if you hear an episode, you like it, and you want to chip in just once, then you can do that too. Thank you. Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. We are stateside today. We've dragged someone out of bed early, haven't we, Zach?
We absolutely have. And you've spent the last 10 minutes talking football and trying to educate us. So I don't know if you just wanted this fellow on to talk football, but, you know.
Well, this was a recommendation from the lovely Carolyn Day, who's like my best friend. Who was obviously on ages ago now to talk about consumptive chic. And she works at Furman, doesn't she? And she sent us one of her colleagues.
Absolutely. So we are joined by Holly Pinero, an assistant professor at Furman University, who has a book called The Family's Civil War that's out soon from the University of Georgia Press. Holly, brilliant to see you. Welcome. I guess this is your first time on History Hack. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I was actually just going to give you a standing ovation for pronouncing my last name right.
Just felt like the idiot in the room for the last 10 minutes while we discussed the plight of Arsenal. But interestingly, for our listeners, a few days ago, I said to Zach, I basically gave him a Tottenham insult and said, if anyone's ever talking about football and you don't understand, just chuck that on the end, because the chances are, I mean, pretty much everyone hates him unless they're actually a Tottenham fan. And it worked, didn't it?
It sure does. Now, yeah, this is great. Finally having my morning coffee, so starting to wake up, and been looking forward to this, so thank y'all very much.
This is brilliant. We're going to talk about African Americans in the US Civil War, aren't we?
Yes.
Right. We haven't done Civil War for a while, have we, Zach?
We haven't. I've got to be honest. It's another one of those kind of areas. I think I'm just rubbish at American history after the War of Independence. I'm very sorry, but I was talking to Josh.
All the redcoats leave, and you're like,
yeah, no, nothing really.
Follow them to Spain, don't you?
We have a quick holiday over there for the War of 1812, and it all goes badly wrong, and then we run away and never come back, and then rely on the Americans to bail us out of the World Wars. That's basically.
Well, there is actually a connection to Black military service with the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812, because, as you probably know, you know, Black men fought. And in Revolutionary War on both sides. And in the post-war of those two instances, they're not going to receive the citizenship demands that the men in particular wanted. And you see that coming up in the Civil War when they're saying, we've done this repeatedly. And we, in the grand scheme, have been given nothing that we are promised.
Yeah, in every war, you get this nonsense, though, don't you? You always get, there's some marginalized group that thinks, hey, if we go and stick our oar in on this and help, then we got a seat at the table at the end. And it never works out. I'm doing Poland in the first war at the moment. And
you're actually getting into like a key point of like, because I'm trying to focus on these families and the reasons why and why they wouldn't. And part of it is exactly what you said. We've heard this story, this song and dance before. We've seen the rhetoric is the same in some ways. So why? What's changed now? And obviously things have changed in very different dramatic ways.
Yeah. So let's start. I mean, our audience is 25% American, which means they know what you're talking about already. Everybody else, I'm talking about all the Brits here, are like, oh yeah, there was a Civil War thing and a film with Matthew Broderick. And then stuff happened, and then Gone with the Wind, and then the First World War. So we need to fix that, because that's basically, I'm not counting myself out of that group. We need to give our listeners kind of an overview of why. I mean, is it slavery? Is that why the U.S. Civil War breaks out?
So I can really.
This is like an essay question, isn't it? Right. Like, just give me a potted answer.
I'd say first, like I've had the privilege of, you know, years ago doing presentations at the University of Liverpool, Nottingham, and also I think Lancaster University. And there was, to my surprise and excitement, a genuine interest in my work and other scholars who are doing some excellent work. I think for me, first, it's the Civil War is part of a bigger story of these Black families' experiences. But in terms of, yes, Glory, the film you were referencing with Matthew Broderick, Morgan Freeman, Denzel Washington, if you haven't seen it, it's amazing. I love it. I've seen it like 1,000 times. I can quote it word for word, which is sad when I say it out loud. But watching that
good film, movie.
Watching that film, I can see how it, some of the topics that I talk about, you could actually connect it to that film. So for example, for those who have or even haven't seen it, when the 54th Massachusetts in the film talks about tearing up their pay as a, you know, through the lens of gender and race, you know, they see it as a denigration of their manhood for being paid $3 less for soldiers at the same rank because they're Black. I try to complicate that and say, what about the families that have been writing these soldiers and are desperate for money? So that act of Black masculinity has direct and immediate consequences to family members at home. In some ways, that continue for a long time. So it's important, I think, to look at these soldiers as people. So my work is looking at them from 1850 into the 1930s, which I'm happy to talk more about. But the Civil War is absolutely important. As other scholars know, it actually takes on international focuses. There's even a book called South to Freedom, which talks about Black, you know, enslaved people who run away to Mexico. And will actually gain their citizenship. And for me, I always thought they were going to Canada. Well, I was wrong. So I think that there's amazing scholarship out there. And obviously there's people even across the pond where you are, whether it's Emily West and, you know, Rebecca Fraser's work. So I think that that's the one great thing is there's so much new, innovative and important scholarship out there.
Mm. Well, let's stay with that as a theme, because I'm interested in firstly, whether or not there's a consensus on the experiences of African-Americans during the conflict. But equally, you know, what are the areas of debate and what are the areas of contention? Because, you know, every little subject has its own kind of debates and tensions, and some of them are harmonious and some of them really aren't. So what's the story here?
So I don't want to open Pandora's box, but I probably will. So part of it, I think it depends on, which this is a great question, what we're talking about. If I think one of the larger debates that continues to go on is whether we're talking about military traditional tactical history. So I would even argue, you know, and the work of Tyler Perry, who has a book called Jumping the Broom, you know, he talks about the tactics of marriage, right? And you see that playing over when some of the soldiers I talk about, they decide to get married on the same day they enlist. So that way their wives who might become widows, their children can get a pension. Right. Mm-hmm. So there's tactical decisions in there, whether we're also talking about the tactics for the choice to enlist. Right. Like many scholars talk about, you know, going back to the 1800s, about the important role that families played. So what I'm trying to argue with my book is a number of USCT soldiers later become historians, you know, not long after the war. And they will say in their introductions and their dedications that they're tired, that their stories are being omitted, even amongst their own people, right? That one of the historians who becomes a president in Kentucky will say that even, you know, our own people are forgetting the names of these great colored men. You know, he'll say something like that. And, you know, Carter G. Woodson, he's hearing these stories as a young person. So I'm trying to connect my work to talk about what soldiers who served in the war were talking about. They're talking about that the women in their lives were the most critical throughout the war, particularly the post-war. There's a lot of great scholarship that's moved the conversations to talk about cultural citizenship, right? So this idea of national belonging, you could even connect it to Benedict Anderson and the imagined community conversation, which I do. Robin D.G. Kelly does some great work in talking about infrapolitics, which is something I use within the lens of military service when we talk about disobedience, how through that disobedience, they're demonstrating agency. Right. But I mean, it can be applied. I tell my students essentially they do infrapolitics when they don't turn an assignment in on time, right? Which happens. But there's been some great scholarship in the recent history, whether it's Tara Hunter, Chandra Manning, Kelly Mesorak, and James G. Mendez, and also Douglas Egerton, which have tried to and done an exceptional job of pushing us, public discourse in general, to look at these soldiers as people. That they come from families, that they're men, that they're sons, that they're brothers, like, and they're important. And for the most part, scholars, other than James Mendez and a few others, have looked at the freed experience because of the dramatic shift that they go through. And it is important. I don't want to downplay that. But I think what's been lost when we hyper-focus on the freed experience, we're losing sight of the freeborn. And unfortunately, as you point out at the beginning, for most people's understanding of the free Black experience in the North, it's glory. And Glory is not representative of the Black experience. I'm not going to argue mine. My, you know, people I study are representative, but by looking at places like Philadelphia, by even looking to the Midwest, by looking to New York City, to looking to these rural areas, and let's say Pennsylvania, wherever, is that we can get a more nuanced story for how people in freedom, who never were enslaved, but maybe one generation removed from slavery, what were their motivations? What were their concerns? Who were they before they served? Who were they in terms of family? Who was worried about them? Who was writing? Who was demanding like to remain connected? And then what happens generations later, once they've died and a relative is asking for them or demanding, to be honest, to be remembered? So I'm trying to, I hope I do a job of it good, is trying to push the conversation. We have to talk about the daughters. We have to talk about the wives, the grandchildren, the neighbors, and the fact that in some cases, these soldiers are also as children living in white families. So they're actually, in the case of Philadelphia, living in interracial households, which really throws a complication in, if you know anything about Philadelphia's history in terms of racial violence in the 19th century, because it's historically very bad.
So you're going looking for these stories. And the stuff that you're uncovering, when you do your research, you found some pretty harsh truths about this experience, haven't you?
Yes. Yes. So, to be honest, this was an extension of my dissertation, and I was like looking at Civil War pension records. And I thought my pitch was like, I wanted to see how these soldiers who are free are talking about Juneteenth, are talking about the 13th, 14th, you know, these major moments, right? Emancipate. They don't talk about that in the pensions. And there's reasons, but what they talk about is unemployment. They talk about disability. They talk about the need for basically a federal social welfare program through the pension. They talk about who they were before the war, that they were in school. That's one of the soldiers talks about his entire class of young boys left and enlisted together, for example, right? So it's, or that they married. And then what happens after the war with some of the horrific disabilities. This is talking about the fact that families become informal nurses and doctors because of even the racism that these veterans will face in the post-war, and how they're struggling to be remembered on a larger scale, right? So their local communities, their families, they remember their stories, but they're demanding that the federal government do it. And this totally spoils the end of my book. But I have a daughter writing to Eleanor Roosevelt in the 1930s. And I could not believe this was in the record, to be honest.
Yeah.
And she says pretty much that I'm a poor Black woman from Philadelphia. I understand there's so much happening in the world. You and your husband, President, have done so much for this country and also for Black people. Can you look into my mother's pension case because she's dying of cancer and we need money? Hmm. Eleanor responds in 7 days. I can't get people now to respond to emails in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And Eleanor demands that the VA, the Veterans Minister Affairs, looks into it, and they do. And then this daughter and the First Lady are having letter correspondences talking about this daughter's wanting to be remembered. And to me, it's so powerful. So even in the hardship, and there is a lot of tragic stories, there's also agency. And I see it more so with the next generation, and also the children and the wives, that they're saying, do not forget us. This lost or false calls narrative, which is saying Black soldiers and the Black experience doesn't matter. They're saying you know, federal government, First Lady in this case, don't forget us. And they don't. So even in the hardship, there's still some positives in terms of public memory.
Why do you think it is that this hasn't come to light until now? Is this something that has traditionally been seen but pushed to the side in favor of things like, you know, you were alluding to before about kind of the glory narratives?
Right.
Or is this something that there's just been a lack of inclination to look at, because it is a troubling aspect of the USA's history, and so, you know, people don't want to have that difficult conversation around it?
Ooh. So part of it is people have been talking about it, right? Like, and I'm saying even the soldiers who become historians, they do, and historians continue, whether we're talking Richard M. Reed, I mean, you name it, right? Like, people will have a page, a paragraph, maybe a chapter where they'll talk about the, or it's woven into this bigger point they're making about whatever the piece that they're doing is on. So it's like historians know that families were always there and important, but centering conversations on free Black families, for whatever reason, until James G. Mendez, because he's the first modern historian to make an entire book on this. And it's a great book. It's called Great Sacrifice. It's exceptional. And I kind of extend the conversation to say, we need to talk about every individual who lived in those homes, because I apply this term of fictive kin that others have used. Because I honestly started to think about my life experiences. I thought to myself, you know, there were a lot of times I crashed on a friend's couch for 6 weeks or 6 days or whatever, because I was in a transition period or what, you know. And every time they opened their homes, right, they did that because they cared on some level for me. I didn't always provide for them financially, but there was some type of emotional connection, financial, whatever, but it wasn't a border, which is a term I used to use, right? This quid pro quo. There was some other reason. So by applying fictive kinship, I can broaden this conversation on what does a family mean? And how does the families experience the war? Also looking at the soldiers as people, which is so odd to say it like that, because I'm the child of someone who served in the military. So there's also that layer to it as well. When my mother served for 25 years and people would say things like, thank you, you know, for your service, I often look at them and they don't say it to me, right? Because I don't think they're taking a moment to reflect on my mother's children, my grandmother, the people who were very afraid for her safety, you know, the ones we're having to help her through her transition of unemployment after the war, like all these problems. And I'm thinking, why aren't we doing that in this context with the Civil War? So even though I'm talking about Civil War era soldiers, it applies to even people today. When I've done these presentations, the people who are some of the most receptive are not historians, they're actually military families. Because they're like, you get it. You see that we're part of this story too. We've been excluded, and not even just in history, just in general, public discourse. We seem to always be on the periphery when we've always been here. Right. And I think I'm just trying to push that conversation more, is if we look at these soldiers as sons, brothers, grandfather, you name it, and we look at them from childhood through their passing and long after, we understand deeper when they're making that decision to go, how they were actually fighting against racial discrimination every day of their lives. And that's really one of the key arguments for the book is historians, in my opinion, need to stop acting like the Civil War or Reconstruction or whatever was this defining moment in these people's lives, right? Or that this was the first time that they fought. I believe looking at their lives in totality is that we understand that they fought every day, whether it was in terms of housing, in terms of access or lack thereof to education, even public transit. And doing that, we then also can see the ways in which women were at the forefront in a lot of important ways. The soldiers, in some ways, throughout the book, I don't want to say go to the back, but the women take the lead. And I wanted to make sure that that was visible, particularly when we talk about the decision for them to go, that the mothers and the wives, they go to the military camp all the time, and they want to keep that connection. And for whatever reason, you know, some scholars talk about it, but not enough, I feel like.
One of the areas you've worked on is it's a national holiday in the US, and mm-hmm. I've literally just Googled it while you're talking because it looks like a typo. Juneteenth. I have never heard of it. I don't think it's going to be familiar to the UK listeners. What is it? And just briefly explain, what's its significance?
Well, so the very short version, Juneteenth directly connects to the immediate post-Civil War. So when officially Robert E. Lee, this guy whose statue just got removed, when Robert E. Lee officially surrenders at Appomattox, which is also important to recognize, Black soldiers were at that surrender and they were responsible being part of a military contingent to chase Robert E. Lee to his surrender. But most people don't even want to talk about that. Right. So there's an example of the exclusion, you know, of Black military service. But in the case of a number of regiments, they will be stationed out in Texas. So parts of the Southwest. One of the reasons is because the federal government believes that there's going to be a French invasion through Mexico with Napoleon III. So there's that. But also in parts of the Southwest, some slave owners are not informing their enslaved people that they have and are free. right? So when the Black soldiers get there, they will, and some white soldiers, they will basically give that information, like, you are free. But then the Black soldiers have to protect that freedom, because if they, and when they leave, what's going to happen is, in some ways, the old slave masters, the old oppressors, will try to reinstitute an oppressive system. One of the things, why it's important, to me anyway, is why it shows how deeply entrenched white supremacy, the need to keep slavery going and to oppress Black people in general. Like, on top of that, it has evolved over time to be a way to talk about Black empowerment, and not just on a United States scale. Like, it's actually become popular in some parts of the world, right? And I think it's a way to take a horrible moment of oppression and spin it in a way that is of empowerment, which is something marginalized people do very well, right? Like, this may have been what it was, but this is what we're going to make of it. And we're going to make sure, in this case, the United States does not forget what we've experienced, right? Though I do complicate that in a new article that I've written to talk about Northern Black soldiers. They, in parts of Texas, they want to go home. They're tired. The war is officially over. They were told that they were fighting Confederates. They told that they had to fight Robert E. Lee. They did both. War's over. They're going to complain, why are we in Texas? That's where they're going to get their most issues of illnesses, disease. They're going to be fighting their own officers for clean water, clean food, right? So it's like, and their families are demanding, come home. And so when we add that layer of the family, of the soldiers being tired, it complicates the conversation about Black freedom when we have Black soldiers still being oppressed within the military at the exact same time.
And this leads me on to, I mean, I know I've sort of facetiously said, you know, I don't understand any American history, but I have taught about particularly American policy and also about the huge struggle for civil rights in the latter half of the 20th century, particularly. And to understand that, you have to understand things like the Jim Crow laws. And what you're talking about how, you know, yes, you might see an end of slavery, but that does not mean equality by any means.
Yeah.
So how much would you say really changes post-law? Because certainly to my mind, the fact that you abolish slavery, okay, it's a step, but it's only a step on what becomes an incredibly long journey.
Right. So I think, and many other scholars you could probably see on the bookshelf behind me. So Judith Giesberg, she has a book, Army at Home, Kate Masser, a number of scholars have basically extend Hillary Green, have extended the conversation to talk about the long civil rights movement, right? And also Philip Foner has done it as well, to even look at during the Civil War era, sit-ins occurred. What I mean by that is, with especially once USCT, United States Colored Troop enlistment begins in places like Philadelphia, where I focus, but also New York City, is that Black people, particularly Black women, will be tired of being put in what they call, quote, the Negro car, end quote, which were racially segregated, or sometimes on an exposed platform where people, unfortunately, in some instances did die or were removed forcefully. They'll say, we're here supporting the United States. We're here supporting these soldiers. We are being patriotic in the ways that white people are, yet we're still being racially discriminated on forms of public transportation. And as Judith Giesberg and others know, these Black women will actually take up legal suits in civil court against, you know, the conductor and like different companies to demand for equality, because they're saying we're giving literally our family, their lives, our everything to this country, and yet we can't even go to support them. And that to me is an important conversation that then shows how someone like Rosa Parks or Medgar Evers, or you name it, is actually part of this longer, richer, like civil rights activism. And one could even say that goes back even before I'm talking. So I think for me, it would say the modern civil rights era movement versus, you know, this longer one. Without question, the Civil War changes everything for Native Americans, for African Americans, for white people in general. As you point out, slavery ends, but racial discrimination does not. I think the most powerful thing, and I'm trying to convey in the book, particularly once the war is over, is that these people who are part of a larger struggle never give up. Because this is what I tell my students all the time, which I guess is really depressing. I don't know if I could keep enduring. Like, you know, like I'm very cynical. So at some point, like, yay, this has ended. But why is this still happening? Why am I still oppressed? Why is economic issue? Why? And at some point, I would have just got burnout and just whatever. But these people don't. And military service is connected to civil rights activism in the United States, not just during the Civil War era, but much later as well. And I think that's also an important connection to complicate when people talk about military service for all its oppressive aspects, which it has a lot, is that it does empower some individuals to use how they've redefined themselves, whether it's domestically or internationally, if we're talking about the world wars, and they come home different and they want to be seen different because they've given and they want and they will demand. And I think that's an important aspect of when we talk about military services in a, you know, longer context, is it does provide, even with all its problems, opportunities for empowerment, which is actually one of the things I'm going to do with my second book.
Which is really interesting, and also kind of integral to that is what you've touched on already, which is these ideas of agency. And the whole point about military service is that we have this perception, and to an extent it's true, of person gives order, you blindly obey. Yep, but the reality of command and control is that it's a conversation. And if you're going to use the stick the whole time, that's not going to be conducive to a good style of leadership. And eventually somebody's going to turn around and bite you for it. So what you tend to see, and apologies, boss, I'm going off on one.
Unfortunately for our listeners, there are three military historians in the room that are going from Napoleonic through American Civil War to World War One, and we're rabbit holing now. You're doomed, guys. Put your feet up. This is going to go on for a while.
You know what? I'm not even sorry.
Me neither.
Sorry, Zach. Go ahead.
No, but this is really important, isn't it? That there. And I'm thinking particularly about the work that I'm sort of starting to move into, about looking at ethnic minority troops in the British Army, where actually, on the one hand, yes, there are unquestionably racist attitudes, but on the other hand, there is an acceptance that you need to listen to what these guys need. And so that, in a sense, perhaps was empowering for the folks that you're looking at.
I think to your point, in terms of, like, I always try to talk about, even within systems of oppression, how people are not submissive to it, whether it's small acts, because, you know, and I'm thinking more so my students. I had a discussion yesterday about the Stonewall Rebellion, right? Another, and they want like large scale revolts. I'm like, that's not as easy as you think, versus more day-to-day subtle acts of disobedience where you're playing the system off to get, even if it's a momentary change, it's still, you got recognized with that change. To your point, I think the thing that I saw that was compelling in my work for the first book is how the military will eventually, in some instances, and I really mean like some commanding officers, not universally, will recognize the importance of families, because at least one officer will start to write furloughs for married men to go home. And he will specifically say they need to go home. They need to see their family. So clearly there was a demand, or at least a request repeatedly. When one soldier will die, a commanding officer will write a letter to the widow and say, keep this document so when you apply for a pension. So even those instances are showing that there is compassion, is that there is a humanity to it, right? Because when some people talk in military service, it's like they don't want to add the human element to it, which is odd.
Because it hurts. That's why. It's because it makes them sad. And it's like, well, it's war. It's
right.
Shit. Sorry.
Well, the other thing is, and I'm trying to push the conversation in terms of, you know, to this point of Drew Gilpin Faust talks about the good death, right? Mm-hmm. And how this the kind of formula, the word escapes me, on how people talked about someone who died to relay the information to a family. And the one thing that I see with these, because there is an example for one of my soldiers, is that through the deaths of these soldiers, which is really sad to say, is that some Black families get to be part of this national mourning, because they're giving in the same context as white families, in this case, who are also grieving. And I think that's an important point, is that they're grieving. They're also excited. They're family members. They're people. And I think, you know, the military, you know, if anyone reads my book and you're wanting, like, this battle happened at this point, you're not going to get that. But what you will get is soldiers talking about, for example, one soldier will write his mother and say, I want to go to battle. He'll say Confederates are cowards because they keep running away. I just want to fight. Well, he'll get his wish and he'll die. And now his family will never be the same. And for the next 30 years, you see how they are still struggling with his death. And I think that's what's one of the most compelling things. If we go generation after the war, how are the families still dealing with the consequences of the battle? And now they're in a different kind of battle in terms of trying to get accessibility to the pensions, which is in itself, to me, one of the most important aspects. How do we even define a battle? Because when a mother and a wife is trying to prove they're, quote, legitimate, unquote, they're demanding, you see me the way I and my community sees me. And the federal government does not always agree.
I think one of the saddest things I've ever seen with the World War I stuff is, I did a book on Eton College in the First World War, and there was, so all of the boys that used to go to the school, if they served together, they were kind of like a unit within a unit, but it meant something to them. And one of them had died in a unit that was quite heavy with ex-boys from this school. And it was the fire attack at Hooger. So, I mean, he got lit up by a flamethrower. But of course, the rhetoric that you give people, like, I can't tell you how many soldiers how many letters from commanding officers and that. They were always shot through the heart and died instantly, died with a smile on their face, or they were hit in the head and felt no pain. And it's bullshit. We know it's bullshit in a lot of cases. So this guy was killed by a flamethrower, and they'd written to the mother and they'd given her that rhetoric. And her fixation was his revolver. I want it back. I want his revolver. I want something to remember my baby by. And they're kind of like, shit, how do we approach this? We don't quite know where it is. I'm really sorry. But it was quite frantic. It was a busy day. And we don't know where his revolver is. And she won't drop it. And she keeps writing. And she's like, but I don't understand. I mean, I don't understand why you can't just remove it from him and send it to me. And the final letter that goes, it's down to a guy who's actually a teacher at the school. And it's just, it's firm, on the verge of cruel, but it's having to tell her, we lost half our unit that day. We don't know where they're buried. There's nothing left of a lot of them. And I'm afraid it's gone. We don't even know where he is. You're not going to have a grave to go to. So I'm afraid that we don't know where it is and we can't give it to you. And it's not because we don't care and we don't want to, but this is why it can't happen. And that's what's really interesting to me, is like how the responses of people who are at the home front and just don't get it. She just does not get it.
I mean, you literally are hitting on like the good death one, but then also aspects of my book, right? Like, she's demanding to be heard. Yeah. She is persistent, right? Yeah. Like, and that she, and they can't avoid this, right? Like, no. I mean, they could, right? But she won't let them. And I think that, to me, that agency is inspiring. Like, because even in some of the examples of the work I'm doing, it kind of has those stories where it doesn't end well. The case is rejected, or it's, you know, it's abandoned. And it's like, on one level, I'm like, oh. On the other, I'm looking at it, what does it say that this mother, in your example, will not stop? That she wants this connection and that she has this story documented. That is really powerful. And it gives a sense of agency, of control, you know, as she's, you know, it also highlights she's still struggling with his passing long after it's over in ways that, to me, go beyond just talking about the battle, right? She was in a battle for that, not just the you know, the weapon, but like to be, for him to be remembered, and in a roundabout way, she got it, but maybe not the way she wanted it.
I mean, what's interesting is the letter from the one she was hammering to the teacher who finally takes care of her and kind of spells it out in a way that's brutal enough without being cruel. Says, you need to fucking deal with her because I can't take anymore. I don't know what to say to her. Right. I don't know what to say. And there's also from the same school. So this is like but within the family, this is believed to be the case, but it was never intended to put the ages on the Commonwealth war graves of the men that had died. Lady Minto, allegedly, so her 23-year-old son was killed at Passchendaele. And it broke her. He was her everything. And they weren't going to do it. And she lost her shit. And she was a lady in waiting to Queen Mary. So she had a voice. She had agency. And she just said, when people look at these stones, it's not the same if they don't look at the ages and see that they were babies and that they had their whole lives ahead of them, that they were 19, 20, 21, 23, like my boy. And that is apparently why the ages are on there.
Wow. So, I mean, that to me, like the parts where I think my book is really, I hope, going to push conversations is at the earlier chapters and then once the war is over. And even like the middle points are really important because you see how families were always there and the issues with pay. But it's like painting this deeper story of these soldiers as children, right? Whether they went to school or not, you know, some of them, and a number of them actually had mothers who were single women that had real estate, had jobs, and were taking care of their household, which flied at the time, you know, in direct contradiction to traditional gender roles. And, you know, there's just these really compelling stories that if you connect it to later at the end of the books, when I'm talking about, you know, in some cases, they're still living with people that were their fictive kin, that, you know, these people have been married and recognized as such in their local communities. But when it comes time for a pension, they're going to be penalized because they're not doing the legal respectable thing of getting that. And you see it, unfortunately, whether we're talking about their offspring, but also in one of the cases, it's so tragic. She will have a her veteran husband will pass and she's demanding a pension. And the pension bureau will say, well, you had this child before you married him, if we can even prove that. And we want you to tell us about the circumstances of that child. Like, how did it happen? So she has to tell about like a committee about the first sexual experience that she has. And I don't need to know it, right? Like, it's to me, I'm like, why? And she basically says, all right, you want the story? I'm going to give you the story. And she tells it. The thing to me that was so powerful was her matter of fact in the way she says it, right? Mm. That she's like, it happened in Atlantic City on this date with this guy. And that's all there is to say about it, period. Right. And it's like, on one level, I'm like, whoa. But at the same time, I'm looking at it going, she's like, all right, I'm going to make you uncomfortable and you're going to hear this.
It was like that Californian nominee for governor, the one that was saying it was okay to say to quiz a woman in a job interview about if she intended to have kids and when she intended to have kids. And I was like, well, if he's going to ask like questions about her uterus, then she gets to ask him how often he has sex and whether it affects his job.
I mean, the invade. So the one thing I try to, and a number of other scholars have done this, Donald Schaefer and many others, is I want to, leaning on their work, is say that families are gonna go to war with the federal government in terms of pensions, in terms of being remembered. Widows are gonna have to, if they're legally married and recognized as such, like, first of all, they have to provide a certificate or some type of documentation. And sometimes when they do it, they never get back the wedding like certificate. And they'll say, wait a minute, that's my only record of our marriage. I want it back.
Yeah.
The pension bureau is like, nope, it's now part of federal records now. And they'll get, rightfully so, very pissed off. And it's like, there's already just like so I have to prove myself to you. But in doing so, you strip away the one piece of that I still have of our union.
Yeah.
Others who were common law marriages, they're going to have issues because in the South, and former Confederate states where slavery existed, the pension bureau will have policies that will basically allow for those who had a common law marriage to get a pension. But no such policy existed in places like Pennsylvania. So they're actually going to be penalized for being free and not getting a legal marriage. And this will jeopardize many family members and particularly children. I mean, my book opens up with one of the most shocking quotes I've ever seen about the Civil War. It's Mary Williamson, and I track this family. It's Benjamin Davis and Mary Williamson. And she says in 1884 to a pension bureau agent, you, the federal government, stole my husband, and we have never been the same when he enlisted. I haven't seen my son. I have nothing. Right. And I'm just like, when I talk about, you know, previously the Civil War, I'm looking at it from this, you know, emancipationist, and even through the hardship, like still freedom. She's like, I don't want to talk about that.
Yeah.
I want to talk about what you stole from me. Because Benjamin will also try to enlist in the regiment that was part of Glory, the 54th. Mm-hmm. He will get a staph infection along the way and miss out on enlisting. But he also does it at the exact same time that she's about to give birth to their only son, Jerome. So it's like, even there is what matters more, patriotism or his family? In that instance, you could say he's seeing it as an avenue for patriotism. Maybe it's access to a regulated wage, but still, he's not there for his child. Benjamin will demand that Mary later give up their child, Jerome, as he enlists in the 6th United States Colored Infantry, because he'll claim that she's an irresponsible woman because she's too young, which I'm like, well, then why were you with her? But she will, before giving up guardianship to Benjamin's grandparents, she'll bring the child to Camp William Penn, and she'll demand in front of other soldiers that that Jerome is their child.
Oh, and the soldier, you make him uncomfortable.
And I mean, yeah, and then the to me, one of the most wildest parts is that veterans years later remembered it. They were like, yeah, we were there. It was weird.
Yeah.
But it's like, and I mean, their story is really tragic, because like, she never sees her child again. Benjamin will die as a prisoner of war in Virginia because he refuses to dig a ditch, because he sees it as a denigration of his manhood. He refuses to do the same work that he would envision enslaved people would do.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, there's so many layers of complication with just this one family that brings to light, this is what their reality was. Right? This is not to dismiss the enslaved experience or all these other important stories, but it is long overdue to resituate conversations on free Black families who have hardships and freedom, particularly because of racial discrimination, is so pervasive, and they never give up.
Well, you've talked a lot today about the pension records, which just sound amazing. And like, I don't know how you get anything done. You'd just be there all day, wouldn't you? Just like soaking it up. Census returns must be so important to you as well, aren't they? They're that snapshot of where everybody is and who's living with who and how it works and who the lodges are and whether they're taking people in. And I mean, I don't know if they're like the UK ones. They're quite similar, aren't they? They tell you how many rooms there are in the house. They tell you who's got an education. They tell you where everyone was born. You can tell if they're first, second generation. They must be a goldmine for you.
Yeah, I love the census, because I mean, on one layer, they can look rather dry, right? You just have this like long sheet with marks and whatever. But what I've, like you said, I've been able to find out marriages, whether they're education, right? Did they go to school at the time? After 1880, the census will start to talk about disabilities. You know, much later in the 1900s, it'll even talk about, you know, where they were born, you know, family connections. But what I saw using the pensions, the census that doesn't come through the pension, is that a number of these soldiers were related, because I kept seeing names in people's pensions. I'm like, why do I keep seeing these?
And because it turns out, of course, their census tells you their relationship to the head of the household.
Exactly. So I found using the census that like three soldiers as young children, like they were brother and a cousin, they all lived together. So I'm like, now that makes sense. And you see it in the post-war, how one of them got divorced, how like he was struggling economically, so he had to live with his brother. And I mean, it's just like, there's really compelling stories when you combine pensions, which are phenomenal. You know, the great but crappy thing about a pension is you never know what's in the record until you get them.
Yeah.
Sometimes there are two pages. I have one that's like 800. and I love them, because when you start looking at who's giving testimony, where are they from? And usually what happens is things like this. If the case is about Zach, I'll be like, all right, yeah, I'm going to tell you about Zach. I knew him at this point. But anyway, just so you know, here's my story. And I want to tell you, because this is the one moment where some people will start to shed light on the Black community in ways that I was not anticipating.
Yeah, it's amazing. I was doing something for an American friend. He's white, but his family were German in origin, and his mom and him are doing their family history. They were in lockdown because they were bored, and they couldn't figure out how this was all fitting in and why this address was cropping up and why these kids switched towns. And it was once you apply the lateral thinking to a census return, I was like, I'm telling you now, they were so dirt poor that they've given the kids to family to look after because the parents vanish and there they are living with some distant cousin in another town.
To your point with the census, the other thing I found was some of the mothers of these future soldiers were land-owning women, which is really shocking given Philadelphia was not the most accessible for Black women to have access to real estate, but they do. And understanding that, and that some were like dressmakers and very successful businesswomen, which is part of the story of helps to shape the identity of their children who will later enlist in the war. So putting those things into context, it helps me go, why would this one soldier leave? He comes from a family that, you know, I want to say is wealthy, but they're doing, you know, they're not working poor. So what is his motivations to come? I would also say connecting it to compiled military service records, that's where you get the cases of disobedience. But that's also where I found the commanding officers writing for furloughs or talking about, you know, the fact that some of these soldiers weren't paid for 9 months. So when we talk about disobedience, when I'm really saying agency, because to Zach's point earlier about, you know, there is this tension. If I haven't been paid in 9 months, I don't care where I'm working, I'm quitting the job. Like, that's just
preaching
like,
to Zach now because his guys in Napoleon in the Peninsula Wars and stuff, like, they're starving. They get done for robbing, yet they're not being
saved. So, yeah, and I think adding that on top of that, if we layer who their family is, now we understand why some soldiers are like, look, I got 7 people back home who are dependent on this. The federal government promised me a bounty, they promised me a monthly wage. It's been 9 months.
Yeah,
I'm done. Contract is void, because I would agree that it's over.
Hell yeah. I think 3 days past a pay day and I'm out.
I'm resisting the temptation to start banging on about Napoleonic stuff because I see so many parallels.
You know what? I'm supposed to visit Carolyn soon in Greenville. I'm bringing Zach and we're going out drinking. And we are just going to do this to death in a bar. We're just going to, all the stuff we wish we could get into this 1 hour podcast.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds great. Like
a 9 hour session in a bar somewhere.
I think that's what's great is that there are so many connections to other, I mean, that's to me when I hope with, you know, even if people aren't necessarily interested in maybe the Civil War, it's the methods, right? Like you can take this from Napoleon, any, I think, you know, war or conflict, and let's add the layer of who are they? I always joke that Jerry Seinfeld, who are these people? Right? But like, who are they? And understanding that, we can better understand how they mourn, how they're fighting to be remembered, how when they have forms of disobedience, like there's so much more depth to it. It's not, well, this soldier is just talking back. Well, maybe it's because he's being told to do work that he sees as beneath him. He was one of my guys was an engineer before the war. I'm like, he made great money. Now you're telling him to dig a ditch? That's not what Frederick Douglass said that he was going to do when they said to campaign. So it's a denigration of their manhood.
It's just fascinating because it's also so interesting to see the transition from my point in history to Alex's through yours. And I can see sort of the earliest kind of murmurings of what comes to the fore in Alex's work appearing in your work that really isn't there in mine. We've thrown the script in the bin.
No script. What script? We've had a great time. If anyone is still listening to this, all power to you, because we didn't care about you at all today. We've just gone off on our own thing, the three of us, and we've enjoyed it massively.
Yes, thank y'all so much.
It's been brilliant. Holly, thank you. Tell everybody again the title of the book.
So it is The Family Civil War. The subtitle right now is Northern African American Soldiers and Their Fight for Racial Justice. It should be out June of 2022. Pre-order link, hopefully out in January or February. Amazing. With the University of Georgia Press.
Cool. Well, we cannot wait that long to air this. It's going out in September, but we will air it again when the book comes out. And we'll
tag
everybody in and we will put it in our online bookshop. You have been amazing. Come back anytime.
Thank you, and go Arsenal.
Oh, and can I just say, to round things off, the thing that Alex taught me, fuck Tottenham.
There you go. Woo! Everybody agrees.
Thank you.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org. where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.